The spirit of performance is what defines Acura. And now, it's electric. Introducing the ZDX, Acura's most powerful SUV yet. Crafted using the same formula that brought them electrified supercars and multiple IMSA championships, the ZDX has track-tested performance that packs an energy all its own. Unlock the energy and order yours at Acura.com.
Thank you for listening to Spin, the Rally Pod, brought to you by Dirtfish Rally School. For your chance to experience life behind the wheel of a rally car, head to drive.dirtfish.com to find the course that's right for you. What are you waiting for? We're right here waiting for you.
Good morning, good evening, good afternoon, wherever you are in the world, it is time for your Tuesday fix of Spin, the Rally Pod. I'm David Evans, in the unusual driving seat for once. Bring back Lisa, I say. Lisa will be back with us soon enough. But sharing co-driving duties with me today is our editor, Luke Barry.
And, hello.
Hello, sorry.
Sorry, I thought I'd jump in and introduce myself. That's fine, we can ignore me. Go on, David. No one wants to hear me anyway.
I was actually going to read out the full team sheet. And making his debut on Spin is what do we call you, James Bowen? You're a staff writer,
writer will do, really. Yeah, man, writer.
So welcome, James, for the first time.
Thank you, David. Hello, listeners.
It is hugely exciting. And what a podcast to make your debut on the back of, I would say, some of, if not the biggest news in the 50-year-old history of the World Rally Championship. Luke, how big is the news that Calle Rovanperä, our defending world champion, won't defend his championship next year?
Huge. Although I'm going to say immediately, actually, just to cover ourselves in case it comes to this time next year, he could still win a championship on a part-time season. You never know what can happen. But I'm being facetious as usual. I completely take the point. And it's massive. It's a huge thing. The only thing I can compare it to, at least in sort of my lifetime that I can remember being a news cycle, it's not even a rallying example, it's Nico Rosberg in F1 when he won the championship and he decided that was it, that was him done. It's not the same for Calle. He's not completely done with rallying, but he's taking a step back. It's a significant change to what we assumed would be the dimensions of next year's title fight. And as you say, we've had 24 hours to digest it, but it's still mental that it's true.
It is completely nuts. It's bonkers. I just a brief aside. I was actually in that press conference in Vienna when Rosberg announced his decision to retire. It was quite remarkable because I was obviously there just to report on Sebastien Ogier. It was the presser just before the FIA's gala dinner, and Rosberg was wheeled in. And I typically was doing something, writing something for a website or whatever, and not really paying attention to what he was saying because it's Formula One and it's not that interesting. And then he said that, yeah, I'm going to retire. And the immediate reaction from one female journalist at the back of the room, she burst into tears, squealed and burst into tears.
Really?
Yeah. Wow. It was remarkable. I'm sure there have been squeals and tears around the world at Dirtfish's news on Monday that Calle Rovanperä will be stepping back. James, what are your thoughts?
I was stunned, David. I feel like this is totally unprecedented. Yes, we've had world champions, you know, step aside before and do partial campaigns, but I don't think we can quite compare it to this, just because Calle's so young and he's so early into his career, and I can't think of an example that's comparable to that. He's only had 4 full-time seasons in the WRC, and already he's stepping aside. So, yeah, stunning news. And, yeah, like you say, what a podcast to make my debut on. No pressure.
No, absolutely not. It's a big deal. You know, I wrote a piece on the website on Monday that, yeah, he's done 4 full seasons. But actually, can we really count 2020, which, of course, was a COVID year, which wasn't really a full year? You know, we're splitting hairs here, but it's very fair to say that he is not enormously experienced, and he hasn't, you know, you compare him to somebody like Thierry Neuville, who's now, I think, done 13 full championships, or, you know, Tanak's been around a similar amount of time. Danny Sordo's been there for the last 20 years, since 2003. Okay, he's not doing a full programme. But yeah, it's a big thing. Luke, we've obviously seen, we've pored over Callie's reasoning now. There is a big demand, isn't there, with this championship? Physically, mentally, you are engaged in that process of winning a championship from literally January the 2nd or whenever you do your pre-event Monty test, all the way through to what was Sunday, last Sunday just passed, you know, the end of Japan, the end of the final round. It's a big ask, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's very easy to downplay, or maybe not even fully appreciate, just how much effort these guys put into this, because for, I guess, for the flippantly unaware, if you just tune in every rally weekend, it looks like they're driving Friday, Saturday, half a Sunday, and that's kind of it. They go home, do whatever they want to do, come back for the rally week, etc. But even the rally week itself is a full week of travel. You're there, it's recce, it's preparation every single night after driving, it's video work in between events, it's video work, it's testing, it's all sorts of things, it's media demands. It is an all-consuming thing. Now, obviously, they get paid for their troubles, and it's a pretty dream thing to do, to be driving a rally car for 13 rounds a year, but there is a lot of pressure that comes with that, and sometimes it can just feel like you need something else. I guess it's for very different reasons, but we're seeing the same thing with Esa-Pekka Lappi, who would much rather, essentially, and it's noble as anything, and I've got so much time for him for this, but he just wants to effectively be a better father for his children and not be away from home as much as the schedule demands. For Callie, I think it's an opportunity to explore other passions, do other things, just have a bit of a mental reset, because I think it's clear that this last season, this year, has taken a fair bit out of him. It was a very different championship to winning last year. We obviously saw at the start of the year that he was struggling with various things as well, potentially. He never really said too much, and good on him for it. It's none of our business. But I think it's clear that this is it's the right time for him to just take a bit of a step back, and I don't want to say reprioritize everything in his life, but just think about things, have a bit of a different experience, because we all talk about him as this 23-year-old, and of course he is 23, but he's essentially been rally driving for what, 15, 16 years? Like, a huge percentage of his life has been given to this craft, and it's you can imagine at some point in life, you get to a stage where actually you want to try something different for a bit.
I think that's maybe...
That's absolutely right, Luke. And, you know, the point there is that it's easy to overlook just how long Callie's been in a car. Yeah, we all watched that video from an eight-year-old driving on a lake. I suspect he was probably driving before that. And it was intense. You talked to Harry about the really, really young days for Callie. And every time he was back from school, he was straight in the car. All the time, he just wanted to be in the car. You know, I remember when Callie was sort of 14, 15, 16, I would ring Harry, and Harry would pass him the phone and we'd have a bit of a chat. And school kind of went out the window a little bit. You know, there was very much one focus for Callie, and that was just driving cars, rally cars, all the time. And then, as Yeri Matti said in his words, from the age of 17... he was semi-professional, if not professional. He was immediately, okay, not immediately, he was 18, I think, when he went into that contract with Skoda. But he'd been signed with Toyota from the age of 16. He tested a 2017 Yaris World Rally car at the age of 16. You know, the intensity was there for a very long time. James, it's easy to kind of sit back here and say, you're 23, mate. You know, you've got plenty of time on your side. But, you know, is it really that difficult to go around the world and to drive a rally car? You look back to when Harry, his father, was around 20 years ago. There was much more time testing. There was probably longer recces. There was more travel. There was more events. What do you think? Do you have sympathy? I mean, is the plight of the modern WRC driver easier or more difficult than it was 20 years ago?
I think we've heard it from multiple drivers, haven't we, David, that the sport, the intensity that's required to be at the pinnacle of the sport now is extremely high, and it's a mental drain, you know, what they have to do processing those videos every night before the stages, trying to gain any little advantage they can. You know, it's marginal gains, and you know that the more the sport develops and the more room there is, you know, for these little tiny improvements, the more depths these drivers have to go to obtain those improvements, and that clearly is just a massive drain on these drivers. And it isn't just about the driving, because you know we talk about Callie and that he's been in the car since 8 years old. He's also been in the media spotlight for a very long time, and particularly in the last 4 years as a WRC driver. You know, he's been thrust into that spotlight, driving for the world's biggest manufacturer, you know, the pride of Finland. That's a lot of pressure to take at a young age, and no wonder he wants a little step away from that, you know, out of the spotlight a little bit, and a bit of a refresh. But it is perhaps a little bit hard for us to grasp our heads around, because ultimately, if we had the chance to drive a World Rally car, you know, we'd be right there straight away. But you know, we can't quite appreciate what Kelly Rovanperä is going through, I think.
I think that's a really fair point. I think there is the level of pressure, and exactly what you say there. You know, it's not like he's just driving for a private team. He's driving for the world's biggest car maker. And the pressure that they would have seen in Japan. Okay, we weren't there in Japan, but talking to Colin, to Holly, and to Elliot, to Team Dirtfish on the ground, clearly the intensity around that event for Toyota was massive. It was disappointment last year, and this year they needed a result, they wanted a result, and to have Akio Toyota around with them all the time, it was a big, big deal. And you're right, it brings a significant amount of stress to bear. One of the things that we know about Kelly's agreement moving forward is that he will be back full time in 2025. What do we think, Luke, he's going to be up to then in 2024? Perhaps a good time to say that we expect Sébastien Ogier will start in that third car in Monte Carlo. So we will start the season, I would say, I'm 99% sure we'll start the season without Calais at round one. What do you reckon he'll be doing then in mid-January when we're all getting ready for Monte?
Probably hanging around with his friends, doing something quite fun, whether it's simply watching the rally or driving something somewhere, drifting something somewhere. I think it is just a chance for him to have a bit of an escape. And you've written that in your piece on the website, David, haven't you? That drifting effectively now is Kelly Rovanperä's escape. It's where and it's not to say he doesn't have fun in a rally car, but it's where he can go. His career is not dependent on how he performs in drifting. It's somewhere where he can do really well and he can really enjoy it, and he can enjoy the sort of thrust and thriving competition. But he doesn't have to. If it doesn't go so well, he's a rally driver. He's not a drifter, if that makes sense. So it's not where all the demands and all the expectations, all the narratives and the media come around him. But I have to say that this whole thing about it being 1 year off, it really intrigues me, actually. It really intrigues me. I think it's a very brave and actually very sort of, he's thinking very far ahead with this in terms of how he's planned it. Because I don't know, I kind of sort of assumed that it would be, if he's stepping part-time, that's kind of it, part-time for a few years. But he's committed to a full year in 25 already. So I guess in that sense, we have to assume that it's not a case of Cali falling out of love with rallying. Because if that was the case, you'd be a bit daft to commit yourself to a year the year after, assuming that you find it back again. So it is just about him trying to have a bit of a break and just experience different things in his life. But it's going to be really interesting to see the difference in it when he does turn up. We're going to assume that Sweden will be his first event, because it's never been one that Ogier's been particularly keen to do, unless he's had to. And obviously Cali's got good form there, so you would assume that he'd be there in February. And I'm really curious to see if he looks different, if he looks refreshed, if he looks more relaxed. And he's been really relaxed this year in general, to be fair. I think winning the World Championship in 22 was big for his confidence, and it's almost, and you hear a lot of drivers say it, but I think it's particularly true for Cali, that he didn't really have anything to prove after that. Yes, this year he won the championship a different way, and it was a much closer fight, and he'll be greatly satisfied with the fact he's done that, but they're all bonuses for him now. He's not the kind of driver, and he said it before many times, he's not gunning to be statistically the world's best rally driver. That's not what motivates him. So he doesn't have to be doing year on year on year to try and get to Loeb's number of nine championships. For him, it's just about enjoying what he's doing. And I guess the idea here is he can take a step back, enjoy the rallies he's doing more, experience something a bit different without the intensity of a championship fight. And I guess the worrying thing for the rest is you'd have to assume that that will work for Kelly. He'll come back in 25 incredibly motivated again.
And it's not often we're sitting here, you know, already looking forward to a rally championship season that's 2 years away. But that 2025 storyline is already something that's pretty intriguing. What will Cali coming back do for the world championship? Whoever wins it next year, you know, can they fight off a rejuvenated Cali Rovanpera? That's a really interesting storyline.
It is a really good point you've both made there, and I hadn't thought about it in that sort of strategic fashion. But Cali is a great thinking driver. He's a very very intelligent young fella. Him and Jonny Halton and his co-driver, they work very closely together. And that could be exactly right, Luke. You know, he could have decided, yeah, I'm a little bit jaded. We, as you quite rightly said, we know there were some issues, some personal issues at the end of last year. He's overcome those. He's had a tough year this year with a few issues in the car and what have you. So it's actually a really good idea just to take time. Press pause, rebuild everything, recharge the batteries, probably work on his mullet, get that sorted, try and grow a better mullet than technical director Tom Fowler. I think he's just about beating Tom at the minute. So he's got a lot going on. And as much as we talk about drifting, you know, that we shouldn't forget that Toyota Starlet that he's got built, that he tried, I think it was Talvi Rally or something in really early this year, wasn't it? Late February, early March time. And the thing broke down, didn't it, on the first stage. That's the kind of thing that he loves doing. He loves spending time with his mates. You know, you talk to Calais about what's your ideal Sunday afternoon, and it's car cruising through a vascular, going for an ice cream somewhere. It's these kind of simple pleasures that he missed out on when he was 16, 17, 18, 19. He can revisit them now. He's still got the same group of mates that he went to school with, that he's grown up with. He's no different with them. They're no different with him. So essentially, he can just catch up on that whole stretch of his life that he sacrificed to become a world champion. And James, your point, crikey, 2025 is going to be an absolute ripper, because whoever wins the championship next year, be it Elvin, be it Tanak, be it Thierry, you can't really see it coming from anybody outside of those three. They're going to be full of confidence. They're going to look at 2025 and say, right, bring it, Cali. Let's see what you got now. I'm a world champion. You know, I can wear number one on the doors if I want to. It's going to be great. And that's perhaps the next point, James. Who will be secretly thinking, wow, this is my time, this is the opportunity, and how much will that opportunity be kind of devalued, if you like? Devalued is quite a strong word, by the fact that there's no reigning world champion there on a full-time program.
Yeah, well, I think they'll all be thinking, wow, this is an amazing opportunity to win a world championship. I think particularly for Elvin and Thierry, who haven't won one yet. You know, we heard Thierry Neuville after CER say that with everything that's great going on at Hyundai at the moment, next year, you know, it's kind of now or never, you know, with Cyril there as the team boss, with FX there on the technical side. Well, I'd say now this is now or never times 1,000 for Thierry Neuville. You know, surely this is absolutely the year for him. But in terms of whether it devalues it, I think from sitting here previewing next year, it could be easy to say that, you know, maybe it's a little bit devalued because the guy who's won it the last 2 years isn't there. So those drivers that we mentioned, Tanak, Neuville, Elvin, they're robbed of the chance to dethrone Cali Rovanpera, which I'm sure is something they'd all love on their CVs. But I think the reality will be that once we get into next season, and as those drivers battle, and hopefully it's a great three-way fight for the title all the way down to the wire, once they're in the heat of that battle, they won't be thinking, oh God, I wish Cali was here, and it will be, you know, an even better fight, an even better achievement. You know, the merits of that championship will be as strong as any other, because he'll be, you know, beating the best drivers there on the day. And when we look back on 2024 in 10 years time, you know, we won't think of it as the year Cali dropped off. We'll just think of it as the year whoever won it, you know, did win it. So I think in the long term, it won't be devalued, although now it can maybe feel a little bit like that.
Can I just quickly jump in here? It's interesting because I'm going to disagree with you, James. I'm going to be controversial and disagree with you. As much as we don't, in the time we've worked together, I haven't really disagreed with you much, but I'm going to do it live on air. It's hypothetical, this, in fairness, because, well, for two reasons. One, we don't know beyond 25 how many seasons Robin Perra may or may not do. And secondly, it's unfair to assume that he's going to win them all. But if Cali does come back for 25, stop winning another few championships, I think 24 will be looked at as the year that he's dropped off, because people look at it and think, oh, well, Cali wasn't there. So that's why X, Y, or Z managed to win. So it's a really interesting one. But I don't know. I'm obviously not a rally driver, so I don't know. I can give my own psychology on it. If it was me, I don't think I'd worry about that. If I'm Evans, Tanak, or Neuville, you've got a chance to win a championship. You go for it. It doesn't matter who you're against. They're still going to have a big fight, the three of them. We know that's true. So I think it'll be super interesting. But I actually think, and you mentioned it with Thierry, and I know it's something he said about his 2024 being the now or never year. I think, to be honest, of all the drivers where that applies to, it has to be Elvin, doesn't it? The last few years, he's constantly been close to winning championships. We know he's good enough to do it, but he's had a teammate in the way. He's had Ogier, he's had Robin Perra. Next year, yes, they'll both be there. And actually, ironically, particularly with potentially better starting positions, they could be the ones that are actually winning the rallies a lot of the time. But Evans is going to be the only, not only, actually, that's unfair, Taka Katsuta's there, but we're making an assumption that Taka's maybe not quite ready to fight for a championship just yet. So Evans should realistically be Toyota's only driver in the Drivers' Championship race. So that gives him an opportunity he's never had before. It shouldn't make a difference within the team, because I cannot see a scenario where Ogier's leading Monty, Evans is second, and they go, sorry, it's Seb, you're going to have to check up a bit here to let Elvin through. It's not going to happen. But I think, particularly with all this considered and the potential for Hyundai fireworks, I think this has to be the year where Elvin, he's going to have to fancy himself, isn't he? And the form he's in as well. I love the stats. I'm going to reshare it. We're not in 24 yet. This season is actually his statistically best ever year in WRC, both in terms of rally wins, which is 3, and level with Robin Perra and Ogier, and points as well. So he's effectively in the form of his life right now, and given a chance that he probably didn't expect he'd get. So yeah, I'd say it's going to be a very big year for Elvin next year. But it applies to all of them, doesn't it?
No, it does. For me, it brings a significant weight of expectation on Elvin. We've seen this Toyota Gazoo Racing is a huge team. They're multiple world champions. They're used to winning. And they're used to being able to rely on people like Sebastian Ogier, 8-time world champion, and Cale Rovanperä, now a 2-time world champion. There will be a lot of pressure on Elvin next year. And if you were looking at Elvin kind of Mark One, when he'd just come out of M Sport 4 years ago, I'm not sure how he would have coped with that. But now I think he's absolutely ready for it. He's progressed, he's matured, he's developed as a driver and a person, and he's strong. And I genuinely think that he can work with it. I think he can deliver the championship next year. and he will have the full weight of Toyota behind him. Not that that actually means much, or if anything, because, you know, one thing that Toyota is very clear on is that every manufacturer driver gets the same. They get the same setup, they get the same, you know, there's not new parts coming in and they go to you and not you. Everybody is treated with absolute parity. But Elvin will feel like a team leader going into 24, and I think he'll respond to that. I think he's grown into those shoes. And he knows that he's going to have to carry it to Tanak and to Neuville. But like you alluded to there, Luke, there's a great potential for fireworks within the Hyundai team. There's not now the same level of potential, not that there really ever has been within Toyota, because there simply aren't team orders. They don't exist. The drivers drive their own rallies and craft their own results. And yeah, it's going to be interesting, because there's, for sure, we've seen Ogier winning events this year. We'll see we'll see Kalyarov and Pera and Ogier winning events next year and potentially taking points away from the championship race. But it's going to be absolutely fascinating. Yes, we will miss Kalyarov and Pera, Jonny Halttunen, and on a personal level, of course we will. They're both great guys. They're always very giving with their time. Big Dirtfish fans. And that goes both ways. So we'll miss them on the rallies where they're not around next season. But it's a good opportunity to segue into, off the back of talking about Elvin Evans being on form and on fire, ready for next year. He certainly delivered James in Japan, didn't he?
Oh boy, did he. I mean, what an unbelievably brilliant performance that was from Elvin Evans. You know, we often hear Elvin Evans at the end of stages. You sort of say, you know, well, I took an approach that was just about balancing risk. You know, I took as much risk as I thought reasonable. If someone else has gone faster, then fair play to them. And sometimes, you know, that's cost him in the past. But boy, did that approach pay dividends in Japan. You know, his ability to read those conditions on Friday, to take just precisely the right amount of risk and build that really big gap. I mean, absolutely brilliant approach, and what a reward, you know, to come from CER, where he had his incident, missed out on the opportunity to fight for the world championship at the season finale. I mean, he's put all that behind him now, and like Luke said, three wins on the year, a really brilliant year for Elvin Evans. But this is probably, I mean, Finland was a pretty good performance, let's be fair, but this was, you know, Elvin on a level above where anyone else was, which, you know, is exactly where he'll want to be going into next year, especially given this news about Cali.
Yeah, it's fair to say anybody who emerged from Friday's madness, Luke, did tremendously well, drove brilliantly to get through those conditions. They were just about as crazy as we've seen in WRC, weren't they?
Yeah, I think we all thought we'd seen the worst of Japan's weather last year to finish the event. Then the event one-upped itself at the very start of this year. It was quite something. And as you say, even Evans wasn't completely immune. It was a small overshoot, but it was still an overshoot. You don't see drivers making these kind of mistakes on tarmac rallies unless the conditions are bad. So as you say, it was incredibly difficult. We see Ogier going off and tapping some Armco barrier, very uncharacteristic for him. Obviously, that earns him a... Well, it doesn't earn him a 1 minute penalty, but the team have to change the roll cage, which in fairness was a mega job to get that done in just over, I think it was 6 minutes over the required time. But that kept OG in second place, let alone in the rally. So that was incredible. But yeah, everybody had a story to tell on that day. So something was happening to everybody. I think maybe the only driver that was kind of drama free was Lappi, because he'd made a deliberate choice to slow down and just not take any risks. But yeah, it was quite something out there. James and I were helping cover Dirtfish Live Centre and watching all crazy hours, but it kept us awake all of that, 100%. There was just something happening all the time. It was quite a special day, but a weird one in a sense, because the rally was almost done by Friday. With Toyotas in 1, 2, 3, all they could do then was lose the event. And I guess it all became about Katsuta's fight back, which I guess we'll get to. But yeah, it was an entertaining rally nonetheless.
All rallying, one source. By now, you know that dirtfish.com is the place to go for all of your rallying news. But when it's time to try your hand behind the wheel, just join us here at Dirtfish Rally School, nestled in the Cascade Mountains in Snoqualmie, Washington. Whether you're a pro seeking extra seat time or a novice looking to get started, we've got programs tailored to all rallying needs. And when you want to watch the best in the world, just head over to our YouTube channel. Our coverage of the WRC and American rallying is second to none. Follow us at Dirtfish Rally across all social media platforms and shop the latest looks in our merchandise store now. As always, rally on.
The level of commitment to drive those cars in those conditions where the car's aquaplaning everywhere, and even at such slow speeds, you know, we saw Sordo and Formo go off. At the exit of a hairpin or something, you know, really slow speed. It was incredible. And obviously by the end of Friday, we saw Andreas Mikkelsen running in an incredible fourth position. One of the issues which seemed to plague the Rally One cars was just demisting problem of just trying to get some visibility in the cars. obviously those Rally 1 cars are space frame chassis, they're sort of bespoke cars, whereas the Rally 2 cars, the Skoda Fabias and the Fiestas, the Ford Fiestas, they're much more of a production based car. But still, James, it was pretty special what Mickelson did on Friday, wasn't it?
It was brilliant, and you know, to see him up there on the timesheets, you know, something you had to take a second look at, but particularly when for myself and Luke it was about 3 a.m. You thought you might be seeing things, but no, he was right there, and you know, that's where like you say, those Rally 2 cars they can challenge, you know, because they're more suited or better off in those kind of conditions. And you know, Andreas, he didn't know he was going to do Japan till the very last minute. It ended up being a bit of a gift, a bit of a go and have fun type event after he sealed the WRC 2 title on CER, and you know, he's got a trophy to show for it. So I think a pretty amazing event for him.
It absolutely was. And Luke, you touched on Taka there. We should really give absolute credit to what Takemoto Katsuta did Friday morning. Absolute villain. He went off. He dropped the car under braking for the same corner that Sordo and Formo went off on, and clattered a tree and rearranged the suspension and steering at the front of the car. But what he did from Friday afternoon onwards was extraordinary. I followed Taka's career in its entirety in a rally car, and I have never seen pace like he demonstrated there.
No, it was incredible. And it's a strange weekend for him, isn't it? Because I think in a lot of ways it was the ultimate paradox. You've touched on it there, but there was this absolute heartbreak of what happened on that second stage. And it's worth remembering that I can't remember what the gap was, but he was miles clear on the splits, like massively ahead of whatever.
20 seconds, you know, ridiculous.
It maybe raises the question of, was he pushing too hard? It's impossible to know. I've not sat back and had time to watch the onboard or anything to really see if it looked like he was going too quick. But the benefit of the doubt you can give him is that corner, as you say, it was the same one that caught out Sordo and Formo, and they were all together in the running order. And Adrian certainly was very clear that by the time he got there, like maybe 10, 15 minutes after he'd gone off, the road had just completely changed. So it was, the conditions were evolving a lot just in a space of a short time. But yeah, it was disappointing for Katsuta's event to start like that. But as you said, the response was mighty. And it wasn't just that he was winning the stages, it's that he was doing it so consistently. It was the sort of thing you grow to see from the likes of Rovanperä, Ogier, Evans, Neuville, all these guys have that in them to just, when they want to, they turn it up and nobody can touch them. And that was Taka on his home event. And it's probably not unfair to say that none of us really expected it. I think we all would have seen him having a good result. And ironically, he's actually had a worse result, as it were, than last year. The performance was miles better. This was exactly what he was looking for in terms of speed. And I think he basically doubled his stage win count for the entire year just in one rally. It was crazy. Really, really good drive. And I think massively encouraging for the future. I guess the key now is to try and find whatever he found in Japan on more events around the year.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it would be fair to say that going into Friday afternoon, he hadn't expected to be the second Katsuta on the classification. His father, Norihiko, was, of course, ahead of him, and did a fine job, Norihiko. He was in the Toyota Yaris, the Rally 2 concept car, but it all kind of fell apart a little bit for him in the Toyota City Stadium when he backed it into a wall, into a barrier, and lost, I think it was a rear wheel. But yeah, it was an epic effort from Katsuta. He will take massive confidence from that. He got a podium at home last year, third. That was a great result for him. It sort of saved some face for Toyota. But his speed this time around was sensational and great as well for Japan. You listen to the words of Toyota Gazoo Racing chairman Akio Toyoda, arguably still the most influential, the biggest man in all of the car industry around the world. And he is so appreciative of what Taka did and what the Japanese organisers have done in rebuilding Japan as a WRC venue, as a staging post on the calendar. It was a great event. There were some issues. There was that one course car, zero car, which was caught by Thierry Neuville, I think, first stage Saturday morning. Not ideal. but not by any stretch, but there's reasons for it. The FAA and the Japan organisers are investigating it, and I'm sure it won't happen again. There were some issues, having said that, last year, but they're getting there, absolutely getting there. It was a great event, and the number of fans at the side of the road, both on the liaison sections and in the stages this year, and for sure in the stadium, it was great. I think, James, we saw plenty of colour from Japan this year, didn't we?
But we certainly did, and you know, we talk a lot about, you know, we want every rally on the calendar to be unique, to provide something different, both in terms of an on the stage challenge and an off the stage display of, you know, a culture, a landscape, and that's what's brilliant about rallying, because we travel through these areas. We don't just go to one permanent venue all weekend. We go through a country, and I think Japan delivers on both those fronts. It's a great event. It shows off Japan as a country, and it's like nothing else we see in the WRC. And then those roads again, you know, really pretty unique. Yeah. You know, immediately from an onboard, you know exactly what rally you're watching. So yeah, it's a fantastic part of the WRC. Like you say, David, still a few issues to improve on, but yeah. I think we can see it being a mainstay for a while to come.
Absolutely. And Luke, we should talk briefly, or not so briefly, whatever you reckon, about Thierry Neuville. How, if Thierry hadn't dropped it on that second stage, I mean, sensational time from him through the opener on Saturday morning, where he took, I think, 15 seconds or something out of rally leader Elvin Evans. Really strong. He insists they weren't going too hard. It was that kind of odd compression, wasn't it, that just destabilised the car. They hit the sump guard and then couldn't get the car turned in for the next corner. Had he got through that corner, what do you reckon?
It's hard to know, isn't it? Because from as soon as Neuville was out of the picture, Toyota's game plan completely changed. And we probably didn't really see the full hand. Well, we didn't see the full hand from Evans, Ogier or Rovanperä, because there was no need for them to risk anything. All they had to do was literally just get the car to the finish. So whether Evans would have had that in him to fight Neuville, it's hard to know. But you would have to say that Thierry was certainly coming at him, and when it was getting drier, as it were. And as you say, that stage time before he went off was mega. I looked at that and I was like, whoa, okay, he's going to be leading by the end of the day at this rate. And I think it felt almost inevitable. I don't think anybody saw the accident coming, but I found it really interesting and actually almost refreshing for team principal Cyril Abitbol to say what he did about Thierry, essentially suggesting that he maybe was rushing things too much to take the lead. I don't know if I agree with him. I can see his point, but that for me, it's just interesting to see that Cyril was willing to do that, because there is this perception with Thierry that he's Hyundai's golden boy, he's number one, he's the man. But this was he's not been as critical about this as, say, Lappi or Sunin when they've made mistakes, but here he was actually openly criticising Thierry. So I thought that was very interesting. Probably very good music to your ears if you're a certain Estonian driver. He's on the way over. But yeah, I thought that was really quite a good touch from Cyril, actually. Just sort of reminding him of the need to get the car to the end, to in a sense. Was he trying too hard too early, given the conditions? It's hard to know, but it was a sad way, in a sense, for the spectacle anyway, because I think as soon as Thierry wasn't in the picture, the sort of rally's outcome became far more predictable, shall we say, because Toyota didn't really have a threat in that from that point onwards.
No, quite right. You're absolutely right there. I think you're also right on the point with Abitbol that he's definitely marked his territory, hasn't he? He is the team principal, and he is very willing to be outspoken about the drivers. Yes, you know, what the one for us earlier this year has been Sordo, where particularly Colin Clark has felt that Sordo's deserved more praise. Cyril perhaps hasn't given him the same level of praise as we thought he would. And it is next year, there is no doubt it's going to take an awful lot of managing to have Tanak and Neuville in the same team. And I think these are the points now that Abitbol is just looking at these and saying, right, boys, I'm the boss. You know, you're going to listen to what I'm going to say, and I think he's doing a good job. He's showing strength in his position of leadership, and it's he's going to need it next year, that's for sure. because there will be no prisoners taken between Tannach and Neville. There's no doubt about that. An interesting point, one that we discussed on Friday a little bit internally, was when we saw those terrible conditions, Colin Clark made an interesting interview with Cyril Abiteboul. Obviously, Abiteboul is a man with a huge amount of kind of Formula One experience. The odd voice in the service park calling for, obviously we saw stage fours cancelled because of the torrential rain, but there were calls for perhaps the event to be postponed or sort of stopped, if you like, the WRC equivalent of a red flag and a reset. What do we think? I mean, were conditions that bad? It's very difficult for us to judge. We weren't on the ground in Japan. But do we think we need greater empowerment of the safety side of the sport to actually say, enough, stop now? Or are we good where we're at, Luke?
I think Friday morning in Japan was probably borderline. And it's worth saying that I think the organizer did the sensible thing in cancelling that stage four. Thierry rolled up to the end of three and he's made the point in black and white that he's never been as scared as he was in a rally car. He felt it was dangerous, and whether or not the organizer has reacted directly because of those comments or just generally seeing the situation, I think they made the right call in not running a stage, because nobody wants to see a situation where drivers just can't get through or can't get through safely. That's just not productive for anybody. There were a few that were suggesting that the tires weren't quite good enough in those weather conditions. Again, I can't comment on that. I have no idea. I'm not there. I don't drive the cars. But yeah, I think it's, for me in Japan, it all worked out as it should have done. Put it that way. Again, that's the best way for me to answer this question, in that I think stage two and three, challenging, great. We won't see that in a rally. Rally drivers are there to be challenged. They want to be challenged. It's what makes our sport special, is this adaptability of the road, the drivers, how they overcome this challenge. But when it gets to a point where, we saw it on Engels the third stage, Robin Perra was at complaining and spinning on a straight, I think, at that stage, sensible things have to be done. And it's a safety risk at the end of the day. And you can't be risking drivers' safety if just for the sake of running a rally stage, which they didn't in Japan. So obviously by the afternoon then, it all sort of cleared up and it wasn't a problem. So I wouldn't suggest there needs to be a different regulation or anything in place. I think it ultimately is just a judgment call for the event organizers in scenarios like this, which I think they got right at the weekend.
I've got to say, I'm a little bit not so sure. We talk about this a lot, don't we? You know, the would a tire's good enough? Would a tire, you know, what are, all of the conditions and what have you. Ultimately, the drivers out there are the ultimate arbiters of their own speed. So if you're fearing aquaplaning on a straight, then lift off. If you're fearing that the wets aren't clearing enough water from the road, from the tire, then lift off. It's a tricky one. For me, Latvala referenced the, I can't remember, was it 2008, the Rally GB, when we had all of the snow come down in Hafren and Meheren, and they didn't have snow tyres. They didn't have any suitable tyres. Even at that point, you could still say you can get through the stage. You just can't, you know, this is the point with drivers, is you can get through, but what you want to do is get through as quickly as possible. Now, that's a totally different question. You can safely make it through that stage. I could drive through that stage, you know, apart from the steep hills, you couldn't get up the icy slopes. And that was where the issue came in GB, was that they were going to struggle to get the FIVs in if there was an incident or an accident. But I think we do need to be careful here, in that the drivers will be up in arms in these conditions, justifiably so. But is it a performance thing or is it a genuine safety thing? Yes, it was dangerous. Motorsport is dangerous. Absolutely it is. But if you're really fearful, then slow down. I don't know. I'm probably teeing myself up for a whole load of anger.
It's an interesting point, though. Sorry, James. I'm just very quickly. And I thought about it that way. I guess the problem is it probably ultimately depends on what you would consider as entertainment. Is it entertaining to see drivers driving at a speed that's 25% of what they can do? Is that any use for WRC? Or you could look at the other way and say, actually, it's mega, because then you see, well, which drivers are willing to take the risk? But I don't know. I'd still err more on the side of caution. If you've got drivers that are genuinely scared for their own safety, not willing to push. I think at that point, it's probably, it is better off just to not bother. But I don't know. I do totally get your point, though, David. And it's interesting. I didn't know the GB stories intimately. I remember the rally, but I hadn't really thought about the fact that they wouldn't have had the right tyres and everything. So it's a difficult one. It's not like circuit racing where things are more easy to predict or control or everything like that. With there, you can delay sessions by half an hour. You can't start delaying rally itineraries by hours because you then start losing stuff at the end. It just affects loads of things. So it's interesting. But sorry, James, I cut across you.
Yeah, no, you're right, Luke. It's such a fine line between safety and you know, having a competitive prospect. And I think if your strategy is to listen to the drivers, and if the drivers are saying they're scared and they think their conditions are too difficult, then we should cancel, then that's a very tricky one, because you're always going to get that one driver who says, no, it's okay, I can do that, and who sees it as an opportunity to gain time, which of course it is. So, you know, can we really listen to the drivers too much on that, or do we need to kind of take it out of their hands, and it becomes purely an issue of, well, if we can't get the safety and the medical vehicles in, then we cancel, but otherwise it's up to the drivers to manage that risk. Yeah, I don't know. It's a very tricky one, but you know, there's always going to be that one driver who wants to go a little bit further, who thinks that they can, you know, be better than everyone else in horrendous conditions.
I'm Kellen Koshel, and I just did my first Dirtfish course, which was the one-day women's course. My biggest surprise was how calm it could be in the car, and the calmer I was, the faster I could make the car go. The surprising thing about driving was that it wasn't necessarily a mental thing. I had to really get out of my head and into my body more, and I just felt a little more comfortable doing that for the first time around a group of women. But I will say, I do feel like I could do any of the Dirtfish courses now. I kind of know what to expect, and you know, hopefully more women get into motorsports, and then any day could be an all-women's day if just enough of us are in the sport. If I were talking to someone who was thinking about taking a class but was kind of on the fence, it would be, you know, what are you waiting for? It's such a fun experience. You're going to really learn something, and you're going to push your limits, and maybe you'll even have some more confidence.
I think teams and drivers and crews are always looking to manage the variables, aren't they, as much as they can. And when we get these extreme conditions, that's a variable that they can't manage. So therefore, they try. Some of them are trying to essentially to get rid of it. It's for me, it's a tricky one. You extrapolate this all the way out, and you're right, Luke, is it entertainment to see a car going in first gear where you're expecting it to be in third or fourth gear? Probably not. But actually, I would go back to the first time I ever watched a Monty from the side of the road, and we picked a corner that had come out of the beautiful sunlight and turned the corner around the north face, and it was dark, it was into the shade, and they'd come off bone dry tarmac. And they come onto sheet ice, like proper thick ice that was never going to melt. And we knew that all of the drivers were coming on slicks. And I couldn't wait to see Colin McRae come there, because I was like, wow, this is going to be incredible. He is just going to fly across this ice. It'll be superhuman. And he came into the ice absolutely break. It was like a Formula One car coming in with into the pit lane, locked up, slowed it down, got onto the ice, and literally turned the ALS down and tiptoed in first gear across the ice, round the corner, whacked the ALS back up, and was gone. And for me, yeah, as a live watch, that was incredible. It was almost as breathtaking as watching a car in Sweden go absolutely flat out through a long corner. It was insane, because I couldn't believe, and talked to Colin about this later, and he looked at me with that kind of incredulous look that he sometimes saved just for me. And he was like, what do you expect? We're on slicks. We have got absolutely zero grip. But they accept it, and you deal with it. For me, I think the one aspect that we do need to look at more in terms of tarmac rallies is the safety crews, the gravel crews. They shouldn't be just for P1 crews. I think Andreas Mikkelsen made this point in Central European Rally last month, that the life of a P2 or a P3 or whatever crew is worth just as much as a P1 driver. And there should be some facility given for them to be understanding how the road has evolved between the first and second pass. So, yeah, there we are. Answers on a postcard, as ever. If you agree, disagree, then reach out to us on our channels at Dirtfish Rally. Talk to us. Tell us what you think. Be nice, though. We like people to be nice. you can make your point in a nice way. But yeah, and obviously, stay tuned to dirtfish.com. All of the news. We've got a heap more Cali Rovanpera related content, a whole load of Japan content, and a whole lot more coming in the next week or so. So keep an eye out for all of that. Boys, anything else to say from you?
No, nothing from me. Just to say well done to James. You got through all that without any... Dave isn't far more controversial than you. Have you not said anything that's going to upset anyone? So it's all good.
It was I'll a strategy, James. Then. I was looking after you there. You see, I was just bringing you in under the radar. Let me take the flak this time. So, James, it's been great. It's thank you very much for your contribution. First of many, I'm sure. And how was it? Pretty relaxed? Were you? You came in pretty confident?
It was great. Yeah. No, thanks for having me, David. It's good fun. We should do this again.
We should. Like every week. Let's do it. So there we are. That was Spin the Rally Pod. We look forward to talking to you all again next week. For now, thanks for listening.